You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Yeah, my name is Durant McKesson. I'm an activist. I was one of the original protesters in the street in St. Louis 5 years ago when the police killed a teenager, Michael Brown Jr., and I continue to do this work. I'm a black man, a gay black man who lives in Baltimore.
Can you just give us a bit of an idea of, I mean, I guess extending on that, what do you do? What's your day-to-day and sort of what brings you here to Aotearoa?
I'm here now because I wrote a book and am talking about the book and the issues related to justice. But day to day, I still focus almost exclusively on issues of policing. Like, that is like what I do. So, you know, in America, a third of all the people killed by strangers killed by a police officer. This is the first year ever where black people are more afraid of being killed by a police officer than being killed by community violence. So I'm part of a team of people, and we work to uncover the laws, policies, and practices that almost guarantee that the police won't be held accountable, because we think that's not okay.
I mean, you've done quite a lot in your life in the past few years, especially, and I wanted to touch on Campaign Zero, which is something you're working on more recently. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it started with this idea, right, that we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. We can get to zero. And it started, the first project we did was mapping police violence. So we were trying to figure out what's the data, what are the numbers? Because people were like, you know, we don't know what the numbers are, da-da-da. And we were like, let's figure out what the numbers are. And then we went into policy and laws. So we maintained the most comprehensive database of use of force policies in the country, and then the most comprehensive database of laws that protect the police. And we work with cities and states to change those. So there are 18,000 police departments in the country, which is a lot. And most of the change that will actually be helpful to people's lives will happen at the local level.
I'm going to get back to your book, but I'm going to kind of go into some questions around definitions and names. How important is it to you that people are able to name or define themselves?
It's, you know, we think about definition as the first act of power, right? Like, how we talk about the world shapes the way that people interact in the world. So what we say about young people often is that they have the experiences before they have the language. So we know that in some people, especially young people, we're helping them develop the language to talk about the world around them, but we honor the fact that they have the experience. And with adults, we are helping to empower them to describe the world that they live in today, and more importantly, describe the world they think they should live in the future.
And in terms of the defining being a power, or naming being a power as well, it's a process that affects certain people disproportionately. So how do we redistribute that pressure of being named or naming and defining?
Yeah, I think that we take it, right? I think that, like, one of the things that I've learned in the past few years is that we take for granted how much naming matters, that, like, we've always called it this thing. So of course it's, like, I think that that is sort of a normal thing. I think that what we've seen people, especially in indigenous communities and people of color, do is just name things the way they want it to be named, right? I think that kids' names are one of the best examples, is that, like, you go, especially in the black communities at home, it's like, there are all these names that people are like, that's a crazy name, why would you name a kid that? And then so many ways it is people saying, like, I get to choose this name, and I'm going to make sure that the name means something in a way I want it to mean, not just for dominant culture. And then the other is to push back on the way definitions function today. So, you know, I'm always mindful to tell people, like, accountability and justice sound similar, but they're not the same, right? Accountability is what happens after the trauma. Justice is the idea that people shouldn't have to experience the trauma in the first place.
I'm interested in your definition of activism or an activist. How would you define that?
Yeah, this is one of those things that I'm not actually, I worry sometimes that we put people in a box. So what I would say is that, like, somebody who identifies as an activist is somebody who believes that taking action is a way to change the outcomes and has a track record of doing that. But I also know there are a lot of people who don't identify as activists who are really committed to doing the work of change, and I'm okay with that too, right? That, like, it actually doesn't have to be an identity for you to be able to do the work.
And because you've also said that there's sort of no one way to do that work.
Absolutely, yeah. If there was one way, we would have, like, we'd know, you know? Mm. If there's one way, we would have fixed all the problems already, and Lord knows we've not done that.
Yeah. Can I get your thoughts on this idea of, I mean, we can maybe call it perhaps Instagram activism, or the glamour that comes with, or fashion that, you know, it is to be able, or to be woke these days. So how detrimental is that commercializing, I suppose, of a movement?
Yeah, I think that the, with the good part, I'll say, is that, you know, it is important that as many people are involved as they can be, right? So, like, I think that what you call the commercialization, I think that it has created an entrance for people where they feel like, you know what, I can go do this. I can go shut that down, or I can sit here, or, like, whatever. I think that's good. I think the danger comes when people think that activism is something that you just sort of sporadically do for 10 minutes and then you pop out, or when people take a stand or seem to take a stand only because they want the attention that comes, right? And what you find with those people is that the moment that it gets hard, they're unwilling to do anything, right? That they are, like, not there for the battle. They just are there for the glory. I think that that's dangerous. But I'm mindful, you know, when people used to say about us, like, we're Twitter activists, and it's like, Twitter is the only reason why we're talking about any of this stuff in the first place, mm-hmm. right? If it wasn't for Twitter, we wouldn't be having this conversation about justice. We wouldn't have this conversation about the police. That we tried to do it your way, the old way. We did it we went to all the meetings. We called everybody. We did that, and it didn't work. But it was Twitter and our bodies in the street that actually allowed us to do something that nobody's done before. So I never criticized it too much because I saw firsthand how it changed our lives.
And I want to come back to that sort of tool. But I also want to mention, because you used to be a teacher, and teaching isn't necessarily glamorous or Instagram worthy, but it's incredibly important. So how do you ensure that all those roles necessary in creating true systemic change are supported?
Yeah, I think that some of it is letting go of the need for control, right? That, like, I think there's one way to think about activism that says, because I've done it long, and this is what we faced when we were in the street. There were a lot of people who said, I've done it longer, therefore I know more, right? And we were like, well, you actually haven't done it here, and you haven't done it this way. So I think that we can actually learn from each other, but I don't think it's like, you have done it longer, therefore you know. And then we also push up against the people who say, I've studied history, therefore I know the future, right? And there are a lot of, like, that's what a lot of historians are like, well, I've studied this for 20, 30 years. And it's like, well, yeah, you studied the decision somebody else made. You didn't actually make the decisions, right? Like, you don't know how it was. So I say all that to say that, like, some of my growth in learning about in the protest has been, like, giving up the control to need to define the way other people act in this space. The only times that I intervene now are when I think people are doing legitimate harm, right? Mm. There are a lot of places where, like, I disagree with the tactics. I'm like, well, I wouldn't have done it like that, or I don't think that was the best way to do it. But I own that, like, that's what people said about us. People told us to get out of the street, right? People told us that, like, we shouldn't go to this meeting, or we should go to this meeting, and we did what we thought was right, and, like, people should do what they think is right. I think that we all have a responsibility to intervene when we think people are doing damage.
Mm-hmm. And I guess on that too, the sort of definition of organizing or creating, I guess, in a way, a movement, but where does organizing actually start?
Yeah, well, I think that all the ideas that have ever changed the world have always started in one of four places, right? Probably like a porch, a kitchen, a basement, or a classroom, right? Like, most of the best ideas happen in those spaces. But when I think about what is organizing is like helping people find their power and then expand that power. Like, that's what activists say, like, go do this thing, right? They're like, come here, come shut this down, let me help you do that. Organizing is about building the capacity of people around you so that they can build the capacity of people around them. Organizing is about multiplying power and expanding power. Activism is about channeling power.
And how important are relationships as part of that?
Yeah, there's no movement without the relationships. The strength of everything we have is actually because of relationships, especially because, like, the movements today have not grown out of sort of hierarchical structures, right? It's not like everybody's a member of this club at school called the Movement Club. And then they go, you know, like, people come out and they sort of form a relationship. And I don't know how a movement lives without those deep relationships. I will say what was hard for us in the street is that we learned each other because of the trauma we were facing together. We had to learn each other outside of the trauma later. So there were so many people who, like, we'd never really had a conversation, but I've been with them for 400 days. We've been in some of the craziest situations we've ever been in our lives, but, like, we didn't know anything about each other's families or each other's lives. Like, we actually had to do that learning on the back end.
Tools, I guess, and specifically digital tools, I guess, but any tools are a big part of organizing. How important is it to stay on top of the development of certain technologies?
Yeah, I think that, I don't know. I don't think that that has to be, like, the activist or organizer's, like, responsibility. I think that the interesting thing is, like, how do you make sure you know enough about the tools to use them when you need them? Like, that really is the question. So, like, I know Twitter very well now. I wasn't like a Twitter savant before the protest, but I knew how to use it well enough. And then when I realized that was a hole, I was like, okay, let me use it this way to do this, right? So I don't think that the activist job has to be to stay up on it. I think that, like, people will do that. And what the best activists do is figure out how to use the tools that they know of to do the work they needed to do.
To use that tool to the best of its potential, I guess.
Yeah, and the potential for the moment, right? Like, Twitter was perfect for us when we needed it to be perfect for us, you know?
But it's not necessarily going to work forever. I was listening to a BBC discussion, that's why I was asking this, and it's about digital technologies and whether they serve protest movements or whether they hinder them. And what they were talking about in the sense is that it serves the protester in that first instance because you're using it to the best of its potential. But there are always repercussions in this age of surveillance. I guess I'm wondering whether you have concerns about how we continue to keep people safe while using these technologies.
Yeah, I don't know yet. You know, it's interesting. Is if you remember in 2014 when we were in the street, it was just so different, right? It was only 140 characters on Twitter. There was no Periscope. There was no live streaming. There was no Twitter video. Like, it was all very early in this space. So I think that, like, if we had tried to do what we did then now, it would fall flat. Like, it just is a different space. So I don't know. The surveillance thing I'm sensitive to because, you know, we got surveilled and we were in the street. And we had to figure out cool ways to get around it. You know, like, we had to figure out how to send out false signals to the police to go to different places. Or, like, we had to be creative about it. And I have faith that people will continue to be creative.
Going back to you saying that there's no one way to do this work, and I mean, there is a lot of work to be done in a lot of different ways. Something that I do come across quite a lot, especially in terms of speaking to different audiences and obviously different experiences. You said earlier that some people have the experience but may not have the words to describe it, and we're talking about activism and the definition of activism. My mum, I mean, you know, I asked what she thought about this, and she's like, a Māori lesbian woman, and she's kind of like, well, you know, I didn't have a choice, basically. I was born into this. I don't have a choice except to fight for my rights and my life. And then there are other people who have never had that experience, right? And a lot of the time there's a reaction to the amount of work that needs to be done of despair and hopelessness in a way. And I'm sort of like, okay, but to some people there is no time for despair or hopelessness. How do we sort of bridge that gap in regards to experience?
Yeah, I think that the reality is that there's no moment where, or like, there are very few moments in history where everybody will fight, right? And certainly almost no moments where everybody's ready to fight at the beginning. Most people want to be the third or fourth follower. Most people don't want to be there at the beginning. So I think about even today, you know, everybody's a protester, but when we were getting our behinds beat by the police in 2014 in August, everybody was not a protester. You know, like, people didn't want to be there at the beginning. So that's that. I do think everything's a choice, right? I get the idea that people sort of are born fighting into this. But there are a lot of people who have the identity that you think would be a fighter, and they've chosen comfort, right? They've said, you know, the world's screwed, and I'm just going to try and do as best for me as I possibly can, given the conditions I'm in. And that is a choice, not a choice I've made or the people around me have made, but, like, people do make that choice. The third is, you know, how do we sort of bridge it? I think that one of the things that I found to be the most effective is to remind people that the problems we face are present but not permanent. I think a lot of the despair comes from people being like, it'll just all, like, this sense of inevitability. It'll just always be this way. It's been this way. We're screwed. And if you wake up thinking that poverty just has to exist, or hunger has to exist, or homelessness has to exist, then I get where the despair comes from. I wake up every day being like, you know what? Man made these problems, right? Homelessness doesn't have to exist. We have enough food to feed everybody. We can teach everybody how to read and write. Like, these are problems that we can fix. They're present, but they're not permanent.
Okay, continuing from that, coming back to, I guess, Black Lives Matter, and when that call was made, and then the sort of response, All Lives Matter, or one of the responses, and that's a sort of fundamentally, you know, missing the point of the Black Lives Matter call. Obviously, there's the contextual beginnings of Black Lives Matter, but also that there isn't really a comparison to be made. I'm kind of using the All Lives Matter as a bit of an analogy to this kind of greater rise of, or just reshaping of, white supremacy and resistance. How do we argue the inarguable? How do we actually communicate when we're speaking different languages?
Yeah, I think we're not speaking different languages. I think that white people know they're deflecting. I think that whiteness, one of the conditions of whiteness is that it's always centered, that it always has to be in the middle of every conversation, and this, and like, of course, it would be in the conversation about race, because whiteness can participate in anything it wants to, according to its own logic. So I think that it's the same language. I think that whiteness just wants to pretend that it doesn't understand. And I think that happens all across the world, right? That, like, part of what we do is continue telling the truth. That, like, we know that the white people who want to believe what they believe are going to believe it whether I say it or not, right? Like, they do believe this thing about the world. I think that what we did that was effective was didn't get bogged down. We had a response to All Lives Matter. We, you know, I would tell people all the time that if I go to a breast cancer rally and somebody yells out colon cancer matters, it doesn't mean that they don't think colon cancer is real, but that they're focused on one thing, which is breast cancer, right? So, like, we had a way to respond, but we just didn't get too bogged down in it because their goal is to get that to be the only thing you talk about. So I try to talk about it as little as possible because that's exactly what they want.
Okay, let's stop talking about that then. You have also spoken about a sort of a lack of imagination, and I want to get you just to describe your book, because your book is called On the Other Side of Freedom and the Case for Hope. So I want to talk a bit more about hope. Could you just explain, yeah, what your book's about?
Yeah, so I think about hope is a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our today's. This notion that, like, people made this up, and because people made it, we can make it better. And when I think about the other side of freedom, it was like, I think we spend so much time talking about this side of freedom, so much time focusing on the ills that we're trying to replace, that we don't always talk about how do we get to the other side. What does it look like on the other side where we're actually free in substance? So I write about those things, and some of it's about the protest, some of it's about me, some of it's about the power of memory and identity and family. So I'm proud to have written the book, and we have so much more work to do, right? That, like, part of the way we win is actually by telling our stories, and we can't fight for what we can't imagine. And I wanted to help imagine a different future.
And what do you see when you imagine the future?
People got to read the book. But I see a lot of things, right? I think that we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. I think we can live in a world where we don't put black people in cages, right? I think that we can live in a world where, like, we help people work through their trauma. And, like, I think that we can actually get all the things that we believe to be true. We don't have to wait a lifetime for them.
Mm. Kia ora. Can I ask about the vest?
Yeah.
How did this begin?
So I write about it in the book. It just, you know, we were in the street for 400 days. It was a long 400 days. And when we were in the street, it got cold. It was 400 days. It was a year. And I needed something that would keep me warm but wouldn't make me sweat. So I started wearing the vest. I kept it on. It became a thing for other people. Like, that wasn't my goal. But I keep wearing it because it reminds me of the protest. I only have two physical things from the time that we were in the street, a pair of shoes and the vest. And I never want to forget that what we lived through was real. It was so wild and so nuts. And, like, I worry sometimes that, people won't understand it or, like, won't believe it. And I never want to forget. And that, like, keeps me grounded.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.